abu.fm on the right side of the home page under community events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Five Centers for the Arts, presenting The Bicycle Men, a bawdy musical comedy featuring Second City alumni. The Bicycle Men tells the story of Steve, a hapless American cyclist whose bike breaks down in a small French village. The Bicycle Men on stage June 5th through June 7th at the Winning Stad Theater. Tickets and information at portland5.com. Also, Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and breakfast. That is, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or Facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. I'm very honored to have Mary Ruffel stop by the studio today while she's in town, brought here by Portland State University and Tin House for a joint sponsored event. Mary Ruffel is a poet, essayist, and erasure artist. She's the author of 10 books of poetry, most recently Trances of the Blast from Wave Books, a book of fiction entitled The Most of It, and a comic book, Go Home and Go to Bed. Her one-of-a-kind erasures of 19th century texts have been exhibited in museums and galleries, and one has been reproduced as the book A Little White Shadow, also from Wave Books. Ruffel is the recipient of many honors, including a Guggenheim, a National Endowment of the Arts Fellowship, and a Whiting Award. She's also the author of Madness, Rack, and Honey, a collection of her lectures that was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award in Criticism, a book that poet Matthew Dickman says is not just for poets, but for anyone interested in the human heart, the inner life, the breath exhaling a completion of an idea that will make you feel changed in some way. This is a Desert Island book, and Publishers Weekly adds that Madness, Rack, and Honey is profound, unpredictable, charming, and outright funny, which seems like a great description of Mary Ruffel herself. Welcome to Between the Covers, Mary Ruffel.
Thanks, David. I'm happy to be here.
Well, when did you first know that you were a poet or wanted to be a poet?
I started writing as a child, and I wrote poems in elementary school beyond the normal school assignments. So I would write poems at home in my room. And there's that. And then I continued to write in high school, but I was also writing stories. But I think I was too young to consciously know or make a decision what I was going to be when I grew up is a question I still ask myself every day.
Was there ever an alternate? I wanted to be an astronaut before I wanted to be a poet.
Oh, there's so many things I wanted to be. You know, I've always been a frustrated visual artist. I would have loved to have been a painter. I come from, you know, I'm old enough that painting was what I wanted to be. If I were young now, I think doing installations and non-genre specific art would definitely be up my alley. There was a time I wanted to be an actress. There was a time I wanted to be, you know, a florist, a physicist. They're just whimsical daydreams that I still have.
Yeah.
But doing the erasure work has been a way for me to go back to those visual yearnings. Using image, and whiteout's a form of paint, after all. It covers things opaquely. So consciously, it evolved. At one point, you realize that this is an activity that you are engaged in and will always be engaged in. There's no one point. Mm. There's no one point, but I was doing this as a kid. You know, for other writers have an experience of taking a class in college and their life is forever changed. I don't have that experience.
Do you have any experiences with individual poems or poets that early on grabbed you?
And oh, yes, I very much do. And I write about this in Madness, Rack, and Honey. I'm not sure what essay, maybe the I Remember one. Very much so. There was an anthology when I was a child, which I still have a copy of, by Louis Untermeyer, who was a major figure in the poetry world and letters, I think, in the 40s and 50s. And it was called The Golden Book of Children's Verse or something like that. And this is a book I devoured. I mean, I devoured it. I read it again and again and again and again. And then when I was in high school, there was a white anthology of European poetry in translation. That book was a similar book I devoured and read again and again and again and again. So my first introduction to poetry was foreign poetry in predominantly European in translation. I didn't come into poetry through contemporary American poetry at all. That was something I read much later. So I could cite those two anthologies as important. And the other really seminal moment for me, you know, I've mentioned elementary school and high school, but the really big thing happened in junior high. I had a knee operation, and I had a cast from foot to thigh, and it was summer, and I couldn't move around much, and it was very hot to be outside. We lived in Nebraska. There was a basement. The basement's always cooler. We had what was called in those days a rec room down there. That's where the TV was, and a beat-up old sofa. And I would hang out in the rec room and probably, I don't remember, watch TV and eat ice cream or something, whatever kids do when they're bored. And my sister was in college, and she was home from college, and she had an anthology of the British Romantics, and Keats and Shelley and Coleridge and Wordsworth. And I remember either she gave me the book to read or she read a poem out loud to me. All I know is she was at an ironing board ironing. I can see her ironing at an ironing board. And I read a poem or she read it. And that moment forever changed my life. It was Ozymandias by Shelley. And I fell in love with this poem. I completely, utterly fell in love with that poem. And I would read it again and again and again and again, and my mind would explode every time I read it. So that's the junior high moment that connects the other two.
Maybe this is a good time to hear the poem 13. If I remember correctly, that one has...
Yeah, that's true. That's how astute of you. You're absolutely right. Yeah, that was the summer. 13. I was 13, my whole leg in a cast. It was like lugging a piece of pottery around, and every human face I knew took a pen and wrote on me. I used to lie in bed at night and read it, and when I healed, they broke it. I walked away without a shard. Paula, Carl, whoever you are, I will not be there to drink the water beside your bed. I read 3,000 books, and then I died.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Mary Ruffel, and you're listening to Between the Covers. In Madness, Rack, and Honey, Mary, you declare at the beginning an allegiance to wonder over knowledge. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? What does that mean for you?
I would rather wonder than know, and it makes it more and more difficult to be alive on Earth in these times when your inclination is to wonder rather than to know. I suppose the example that comes to mind is, it used to be if you were having dinner with people and someone said, who's the fastest animal on earth? Everyone, an amazing conversation would ensue. And now someone pops their phone out and looks up the answer. And that breaks my heart. This idea of access to answers and information, believing that they're all the truth, which is not always true. I really, really don't like it when people look things up on their iPhones. I would rather talk about, I mean, sometimes, of course, I'm no idiot, the encyclopedic nature of the information that's available is fantastic. But I still would rather wonder than know. And I think wondering is a way of inhabiting and lingering. There seems to be more dwelling, to dwell, inhabit, and linger. I'm interested in those things. And you can do that when you don't know. We tend to, as human beings, our impulse is once we know, once we have the answer, we move on. So we're constantly moving from one thing to another, and I would rather inhabit the question or dwell. For me, that is the place that I want to live in. I have an encyclopedia at home, and it never occurred to me there was anything wrong with it till my friend pointed out it was Encyclopedia Britannica from 1910, and it might be a little outdated, but I still look things up. I still look things up in it, and it's amazingly detailed. I was looking up the Belgian Congo, and I mean, because it was the Belgian Congo in 1910, and of course I know it no longer is, and it was like 30 pages almost transcribing a meeting in Parliament to decide, or something was for independence, or for, it was so detailed. It was astounded me. I don't have the facts quite right, but.
Would you think that facts and certainty are in opposition to poetry and art?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Facts and certainty are not the business of an artist. You know, the business of an artist is to pay attention. And by paying attention, you're inhabiting a moment, because you're entering a moment, even though time is passing. And facts and certainty, I think, would have to do with a larger scope of time. And facts and certainty are always changing. I mean, they're constantly changing. We're given medical facts, I mean, that become untrue 25 years later.
Right.
So,
well, you say at the end of one poem, I think, something of the sort of, I detest exactness. And I wonder if maybe that is partly pointing to like a dishonesty in the in it being exact at all.
Well, part of me is dishonest because I also am an extremely exacting person. I say in a poem that I despise exactness, but if you visited my apartment, your overall impression would be, here is a person who is obsessed with exactness. I have to admit that, but we're all contradictory people, and I am no different. I'm very full of contradictions.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today to poet and essayist Mary Ruffel. A couple weeks ago, Mary, I was at a reading of Mark Doty, and he is a big fan of Walt Whitman, and he was describing going to a used bookstore to pick up a copy of Leaves of Grass to bring to teach, and he didn't open it before he taught, and he went and opened it, and there were all these writings by a previous reader. And there's a section in Leaves of Grass where it says, what is the grass? And the person in the margin writes, it's grass. And he remembers being very mad that this person would write something that way. But then he realized that this reader had a certain deep faith in the power of language, that this word grass corresponded to the thing grass and everything that grass was. And that poets were really, they were more oriented to the ways in which language didn't correspond to the mystery.
Yes.
And that's why Walt Whitman had to write 300 pages to answer this question.
Yes.
Does that resonate with you?
Well, first of all, I love Walt Whitman. And I love marginalia. And I think Mark was very lucky to find this book. I love finding marginalia in old books. And that's a wonderful page. I would have framed it and put it in a frame. What is grass? It's grass. Oh, well, thinking about that, my mind goes a million different places. I could tell you about some frame marginalia I have in my apartment, or I could also tell you about my Whitman sampler. Well, I'll go here in direct relation to Mark Doty's comment on that. There is a famous Buddhist lesson. It goes way back. I can't tell you right off the top of my head where it originates, but it goes like this. When I first began to study, mountains were mountains and rivers were rivers. After I had studied for some while, I realized that mountains were no longer mountains and rivers were no longer rivers. And after I had studied for a very long time, mountains were mountains and rivers were rivers.
Hmm.
And I've always loved that. And I think that it's true not only for spiritual seekers, but for artists and people invested in creativity and language. We go through, you know, when we're kids, grass is grass, and then grass is, we don't know what grass is, and it's a great mystery, and it becomes a million other things. And perhaps when we're old, it's grass is just grass again. I don't know. But it's that little quote, which of course I botched, but has to do with metaphor, and a central issue of metaphor, because I think that the central area where you say mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers has to do with the power of metaphor to connect things, a belief has to do with metaphor.
I'm not sure why this particular poem comes to mind, but would you be willing to read How I Became Impossible?
Oh, yeah. I'd love to. How I Became Impossible. I was born shy, congenitally unable to do anything profitable, to see anything in color, to love plums, with a marked aversion to traveling around the room, which is perfectly normal in infants. Who wrote this were my first words. I did not like to be torched. More snow fell than was able to melt. I became green-eyed and in due time traveled to other countries where I formed opinions on hard, cold, shiny objects and soft, warm, nappy things. Late in life, I began to develop a passion for persimmons and was absolutely delighted when a postcard arrived for the recently departed. I became recalcitrant, spending more and more time with my rowboat. All my life, I thought polar bears and penguins grew up together, playing side by side on the ice, sharing the same vista, bits of blubber, and innocent lore. One day, I read a scientific journal. There are no penguins at one pole, no bears on the other. These two, who were so long intimates in my mind, began to drift apart, each on his own flow, far out into the glacial seas. I realized I was becoming impossible, more and more impossible, and that one day it really would be true.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Mary Ruffel, and you're listening to Between the Covers. I would love to talk to you about contradiction. That poem ends in a contradiction, as many of your poems delve into them. And it feels like the realm of contradiction is often in the world of religion. And you use a lot of religious and mythological imagery and allusions in your poems. But it seems like in America, there's this sort of binary where if you aren't actually a practicing religious person, the only other option seems to be a secular humanist, someone who raises reason and elevates reason and believes that the opposite of knowledge is ignorance, not wonder. But somehow it feels like you've pointed to a lesser known or spoken of third way of using the language of religion, wonder, mystery, contradiction, without necessarily espousing religion. Can you talk about how those images are and themes are operating for you in poems?
Knowledge is wonder to me, I suppose, or a form. I've been interested in religion as far back as I can remember. Again, it starts in high school when you may be raised in one religion or another. I happen to have been raised Catholic. Not fervently. I never went to Catholic school, but that was an early, obviously, implant. But in high school, if you're a reasonably intelligent person, creative person in high school, you begin to be curious about world religions. I remember in high school, I said, okay, I'm going to read the Bhagavad Gita. I'm going to read the Upanishads. I'm going to, you know, study Buddhism. I'm going to read the Quran, which I actually read in high school and, of course, should reread it. But it was simply, I don't know where that came from, but it was always there and it has always been there. Actually, I was rereading Kafka's letter last night in the hotel room. I picked it up at Powell's. Of course, it's been years since I read it, and a friend of mine had mentioned it, so I bought it on sale at Powell's yesterday, and I was reading it last night, and it's only about 100 pages, and I came across, may I share it with you? Because this is an example of what struck me as a person. He says, I have worried for as long as I can recall so deeply about asserting my spiritual existence that nothing else has ever mattered to me. Hmm. Now, I obviously copied that because it spoke to me and resonated with me, and I felt the same way, and I thought that was astonishing. I have worried for as long as I can recall so deeply about asserting my spiritual existence that nothing else has ever mattered to me. And he also, on the same page right before, which made me laugh, the second did not. It sort of sent shivers down my spine, but this made me laugh. It's taken out of context from the middle of a sentence. He goes, my not altogether hopeless analytical ability, which if you know, Kafka, you know, was trained as a lawyer, but whose writings are the entire letter that this is in is 100 pages of analyzing his relationship with his father. Right. And he's insanely analytical. Hmm. I mean, his creativity comes out of insane analysis. And he says, my not altogether hopeless analytical ability. I just burst out laughing. So
a lot of people don't think of Kafka as funny, and he is often funny as
well. He's hysterical.
Well, speaking of this dedication to a spiritual existence, you in your 50s, I've heard, dedicated or rededicated yourself in a different way to poetry. Can you talk about...
I did.
You didn't?
No, this is news to me.
Oh, really?
What did I do in my 50s? I'm 63 now. What did I do in my 50s? What did you hear? I love it.
I had heard that you had made some sort of pact with yourself. I mean, maybe this is just urban lore, right? Or rural lore.
Tell me. I want to know. Did you? I made a pact. What was the pact that I made?
That's what I was going
to
ask you.
Oh, you were going to ask me. You heard. I rededicated myself to poetry and made a pact. Well, I have no memories, but it is true. Enormous life changes occur in your 50s. Hmm. You know, midlife crises, that's not urban lore. It's real, and every one of you will experience it. And your priorities shift. Everything just shifts. And you have to decide what's important and make decisions and go with it. I think it was in my 50s that I gave up seeking full-time gainful employment. I had pursued that for many years, and I stopped. I threw my cover letter out. I threw all the names, and I took myself off the job list. And I mean, for paid access to. I know that I did that, but.
Well, I can tell you where my imagination went.
Yeah, sure.
Speaking of letters, since you were talking about Kafka's letters, I was thinking of Rilke's letters on Cézanne that he wrote to his wife. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but he was really obsessed with what Cézanne did in the latter part of his life. And the way that Rilke saw it was a sort of renunciation of everything to become one thing, which was the final unification with his work. And Rilke wanted that desperately and seemed extremely tortured on how to get there.
It's a never-ending struggle. And yes, I suppose something like that happened. I'm not alone. It happens to lots of people and also in a wide variety of ways. It's fair to say that the first half of my life, well, my life's much more than half over. My life at one point was very compartmentalized. And I used to think about it. I used to ask friends, query them about their lives and the compartmental. And let me give you an example. When you're still living with your family, you have your family, but you have school, and then you have the private world inside your head when you're listening to music with earphones on in your room or whatever. You have your school life, your private life, and then you have your gang of friends, if you're lucky, you know. And that private life in the head would also include reading. You know, so your life is compartmentalized. At least mine was. I didn't tell my parents everything that was going on in the other aspects. And it continued to be that way for me for a very long time. And then eventually you enter into intimate relationships and you have partners and there's that. And then you get a job, but you still have the life of your mind. And you have a life in a community. My life was always felt compartmentalized, and it slowly became less and less compartmentalized. And I no longer feel all our lives are compartmentalized to an extent. But I no longer feel sharp divisions. My life does feel unified. I feel, it's really hard to describe, but on Mondays in the laundromat, it's not a different part than if I'm doing erasure in the morning. It feels like it's just one unit of living that I don't turn. My being a poet or artist doesn't get turned on and off. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get turned on and off. That's for sure. It's not something I do between the hours of X and Y. Yes. And that's a wonderful feeling. And it's why nobody should fear aging. Aging has negative aspects to it, obviously. But should never fear aging because you have no idea the freedom. The absolute freedom inherent in aging is astounding and mind-blowing.
You've been listening to the first half of an hour-long interview with poet, essayist, and erasure artist Mary Ruffel. If you want to hear the whole hour interview, you can go to the website kboo.fm/betweenthecovers. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
Out Loud is retiring in June, but queer programming will continue on your community radio station. KBOO is proud of our longtime support of programming serving and featuring the area's queer community, and while we prepared to say goodbye to Out Loud, we welcome the opportunity for new programs to continue airing in Out Loud's time slot every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. More information is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/outloud.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of One Flaming Arrow, an intertribal art, music, and film festival curated by RISE, Radical Indigenous Survivance and Empowerment. This event will take place from June 2nd through the 14th at Surplus Space and multiple venues within Portland, Oregon, Indigenous lands of the Chinook tribe. One Flaming Arrow seeks to evolve the dialogue of Indigenous survivance by introducing a biennial art, music, and film festival. The festival advocates Native expression of autonomy through the warrior spirit. It stands to disrupt the hegemonic white noise of contemporary culture by focusing on non-conventional exhibition spaces and non-neo-traditional Native artists. Spaces created for the radically political, experimental, and emerging. Surplus Space, located at 3726 Northeast 7th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. For more information, visit oneflamingarrow.com. Special thanks to PICA's Precipice Fund, Calligram Foundation, and the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts.